Now, if you notice, we only have 3 weeks of the course left. You should be able to see the shared screen now. Let me know if you cannot see it. Right, this week we'll talk about corporate governance and corporate control. And Grayson put a fantastic, or maybe it was Dan, put a fantastic picture of Michael Milken from Wall Street on the syllabus page. I'm looking forward to the new movie. You know, there's a Oliver Stone has made a sequel. I think it's called Money Never Sleeps, although it's unofficially known as Wall Street 2. Still has Michael Douglas in it, what's that kid's name? Shia LaBeouf. So I'm curious to see if it'll be any good. I really enjoyed the first Wall Street, even though of course I didn't agree with Oliver Stone's main perspective. That what Gordon Gekko and his ilk were doing was evil. In fact, I thought Gekko was the hero of the movie. I was cheering him on. The heck with that silly old blue star. Anyway, we can talk about that later. But that's going to be our discussion topic for today. Next week, we'll talk in more detail about the role of the state and how it affects the firm, how it affects the corporation specifically, the relationship between entrepreneurs and the state, and I think that'll be very interesting. I still have not decided what is the optimal reading for next week's session, so I need to remember to put that to add that to the syllabus as soon as I can. And then the week after that, we'll have time just for some general reflection, review, comment, discussion, and then we'll be done. So we'll have a final exam at the conclusion of the course. So probably the weekend after that last week, July 31st to August 6th, the first weekend in August, so not August 1st, but probably August 7th, around then is when we'll do the final exam. One other comment on exams, the final exams are graded, but as Grayson can explain better than I can, there's some kind of a weird glitch with the... There's a weird glitch in the way DimDim is reporting these things. So if you look at your individual exam results, and I'd prefer that you not do that now, but wait till we're finished with our session today. You can see your scores on the individual items, but for some reason DimDim doesn't add up the numbers correctly. I'm not sure why it can't add four numbers together, but apparently it comes up with a score. So don't be shocked if you look and if it says your exam score is 58 or 62 or something, that's wrong. You have to go in there and add up the scores on each question. Grayson is fixing this. sorry, I said DimDim. I should have said Moodle. Moodle is what I meant. Grayson has a workaround for this. He is creating a new graded item, which will just be called midterm score, where we'll just go through and add up your scores correctly and paste them in there. So don't pay any attention to what Moodle says is your total score. Also, there is a document that should be up on the site very soon that Grayson, if you could, or Dan, if you could take care of that, has some commentary on the midterm exam. Overall, the exams were great. I mean, I was very impressed with the scores. Almost everybody understood almost all of the questions extremely well, which is not surprising when you consider the outstanding teaching that you've been exposed to this semester. No, seriously, you guys have worked hard and you've kept up, and it showed very nicely on the exam. I did have some comments on individual answers, and then some overall comments on the exam itself. And I hope you'll get a chance. You'll take some time to look through that document, especially on the questions that you didn't answer. Think about, what you might have said, and you can see some notes and comments from me on, sort of what I was looking for on each one of those. So again, that's a separate document, a PDF file. It's called Notes and Comments on the Midterm Exam. So look at that as you're looking at your own answers and any comments and scores that I have assigned to your individual answers. Again, the object in this course is not to worry about grades, but to focus on learning and camaraderie and networking and so on. But it is useful to have some assessment as well. But I don't want you to spend too much time worrying about that. Obviously, if you have any questions about the numerical scores, I'm more than happy to talk to you about that privately. I don't want to quibble over a point here or a point there, but if you want to talk about what you wrote and why, if you think that maybe I misunderstood something that you said, or if you misunderstood something in the question, or if something doesn't make sense to you in the comments and suggested answers, by all means, just drop me a note, call me, whatever. I'd be happy to discuss that with you one-on-one. Okay. Now I've made the classic rookie teacher mistake of talking about the exam, especially when you guys are sitting in front of a computer screen. So no one will be listening to anything I say for the next 15 or 20 minutes as you try to figure out how to retrieve your exam scores, how to add up the numbers, and so on. But fortunately, we have this lecture recorded, so you can come back and listen to me later. But I'm going to act as if none of that has happened and that you're all eager beavers and ready to learn about corporate governance and corporate control. By the way, on readings, I'm also interested in, yeah, very funny, Dean. I also was looking for a good kind of newspaper article on the Dodd bill, a good summary of this legislation that's just passed through both houses of Congress, will likely be signed into law by the president just in a few days, to give us something to talk about. Talk about what are some of the specific corporate governance and control provisions in that legislation. Talk about it in the context of the Sarbanes-Oxley reform of 2002 and the more general governance issues that we'll be talking about today. I didn't find what I thought was a really good summary and analysis of the Dodd bill. If anyone has come across one, please alert us to that. Tell us about that in the forums, and maybe we can talk a little bit about how some of the general issues we're discussing today help us to understand what's going on with the so-called financial reform package. But without further ado, let's talk a little bit more generally about corporate governance and corporate control. I assigned you chapter two of the book, which is sort of good background, but I'm not going to follow strictly point by point chapter two in the lecture today. I want to talk a little bit more generally, okay? Okay, what exactly do we mean by mergers, acquisitions, divestitures, the kinds of changes in firm boundaries that corporate governance and corporate control is particularly concerned with? The key thing to remember is that things like mergers, divestitures, reorganizations, and so on are just changes in the boundaries of the firm. Right? Now, we already spent 2 or 3 weeks talking about boundaries, what you might call optimal, quote unquote, in the loose sense of that term, optimal boundaries and organization. A firm should be organized this way. It should be vertically integrated or it should not be. It should be diversified or specialized. It should be focused or it should be a conglomerate. It should be centralized or decentralized. We pointed out at that time that even if the entrepreneur has a sense of how the firm should be sized and shaped, the firm may not be there today. And so it may require some changes to get that way. We need to become bigger or become more smaller. We need to re-engineer or reorganize or whatever. So we might need some additional theories that will help us to understand how we change from one type of organizational form or structure to another. So we need to think about transition costs, right? There's organizations like people are often affected by inertia, right? It's easier to do things the way you've always done them in the past. There are costs to learning new things, costs to disrupting existing routines and practices and so on. And those need to be taken into account in looking at any kind of reorganization, right? Just for example, suppose that you decided that your firm was too small and you wanted to get bigger, right? Well, you could do so by acquiring an existing firm or by, buying some new machines and hiring some new workers and simply adding incrementally to your existing operations. That's two different methods, two different means, right, of getting to a larger size. Which of those means is more appropriate? under your circumstances. Well, that's something that the entrepreneur owner, the capitalist entrepreneur, has to study and take into account, right? The reason I'm giving you this background is because merger, in particular, acquisitions, takeovers, and so on, are particularly important means of exercising corporate control and corporate governance, right? Ownership and governance, of course, are extremely important. Who owns the firm? Who manages the firm? Who monitors the firm? How all this takes place is extremely important for understanding the behavior and performance of the firm. Things like takeovers are one particularly important mechanism, not only by which a firm can change its boundaries, but by which other firms and external market participants can discipline or control what an existing firm does, right? I mean, it's important to use sort of value-neutral terms like discipline, and control, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about corporate governance and corporate control transactions, right? Especially comes through the media, right? The whole concept of a hostile takeover, as opposed to a friendly takeover, right? I mean, this was a media term. These were media terms that were coined in the 1980s. In the merger wave, takeover wave of the 1980s, all they mean is, right, a friendly, so-called friendly takeover is one in which the firm's current management, the incumbent managers, are working with the new owners, the group trying to take control of the firm. Whereas a so-called hostile takeover is one in which the incumbent management is not in favor of the merger or the takeover and tries to resist the new owners taking control of the firm. Well, I mean, if one reason for a reorganization or an acquisition, in this case, is to replace the managers of the target firm who are not doing their jobs very well, well, it's no surprise that they would resist any sort of efficiency improvement that would cost them their jobs. But the media bring up this image of, violence and coercion, sort of militaristic terms like, a raider, right? Well, a raider in everyday English is some kind of a pirate, right? A privateer. The idea that Michael Milken or the Gordon Gekko character in Wall Street is a raider is meant to connote this sort of swashbuckling guy with knives and guns who comes and steals stuff and kills people and all that. Well, that's not what raiders, that's not what corporate raiders do. These are simply individuals who seek to purchase corporate assets, buying and selling stock and so on. There's no coercion whatsoever involved. I've always liked this cartoon. This is one of these old Sidney Harris cartoons from the New Yorker. I don't know if you can read the quote. The secretary says, "An investment group from Tokyo is here. To me, it looks like a hostile takeover bid." There they are in their samurai garb, right? Well, that's a so-called hostile takeover has nothing to do with knives and guns. Why are ownership and governance important? Now, before you say, well, duh, of course they're important, think back to neoclassical economics and the neoclassical concept of the firm as a production function, right? All that matters is the productive technology, the black box that converts factors of production into outputs, right? I mean, who owns the black box? How the black box is governed or controlled by its owners? I mean, that's sort of irrelevant. None of those issues come into play in a purely technological explanation for production and for the firm, right? If we're interested in an entrepreneurial perspective, then who owns what assets? How does the owner govern and control those assets? Well, those are obviously critically important issues in how the organization performs. But you wouldn't think so if you only read sort of mainstream neoclassical microtheory. Okay? What are some things that we mean, right? What do we mean by ownership and governance anyway? Well, one issue is, the purely legal form of ownership is for a given set of productive assets, right? An entrepreneur plus a set of productive assets the entrepreneur controls. This firm could be organized in a number of different ways. It could be a sole proprietorship, where the capitalist entrepreneur holds 100% of the equity, one single person. It could be organized as a general partnership among several capitalist entrepreneurs, or some kind of limited liability partnership. We'll talk a little bit more about limited liability next week, but here I simply mean that the equity owners when they borrow money from the bank or when they issue bonds to bondholders, they include as part of the contract that the creditor, in the event of non-payment, in the event of default, the creditor cannot take the personal assets of the partners. They could organize themselves as a limited partnership, or what in the U.S. is called an S-corp, or limited liability, an LLC, a C-corp, right? You could be the C-corp, meaning a publicly traded corporation with equities that are bought and sold on secondary markets. These are all different options for legal ownership. Again, in the neoclassical approach to the firm, these things don't matter, right? They don't matter for production, for profitability. They're just things that lawyers might worry about. If we take firms, we think seriously about the firm as an organization, owned and controlled by entrepreneurs, then these things obviously would be important, right? Why? Because ownership determines who gets the residual profit or income stream, right? Remember, in the Knight Mises notion of profit, profit is a residual, right? It's what's left over after the factors of production have been paid. So who gets this residual is extremely important, right? Who gets the profit? Well, that affects incentives. It affects decisions about what factors to add and subtract and everything else. Also, in the context of uncertainty, genuine uncertainty, there's the issue of control rights, decision control rights. Okay? In the event of circumstances that nobody foresaw, who gets to decide how the productive assets will be used? Well, that's the essence of ownership. So, say that Grayson and Dan and I, the three of us, are all working together as part of a productive team, right? Which we actually are in putting this course together. But say, we're producing bottled water or whatever. All three of us are contributing our labor. But, does it matter if I'm the owner and Grayson and Dan are my employees? Or if Grayson is the owner and Dan and I are his employees and so on? From an entrepreneurial perspective, it absolutely does matter, because the entrepreneur is the ultimate decision maker about whom to hire, whom to fire, what resources to add and to divest, etc. Right? So you can't just say there are three units of labor and some machines and off you go. We need to say who controls the assignment of those resources. Right? Who holds the residual control rights? That's the entrepreneur owner. And it makes a difference who those rights are assigned to. Okay? Now, of course, there are some purely legal and tax-related issues about ownership, right? Companies incorporate or register under different statutes in some cases because of differential tax treatment. Cooperatives, for example, in most U.S. states get charged a lower tax rate than corporations. There are legal liability issues as well, whether you want to take on full liability for debts when you borrow money from the bank, or whether you want to stipulate in the contract that your personal wealth is not being offered as collateral and so on. I mean, these are issues that people would simply work out on a case-by-case basis, right? It turns out, I mean, it's sort of a widely known sort of factoid that surprises people when they haven't heard of it before, right? Roughly that in the U.S. and in most Western economies, the vast majority of firms are sole proprietorships, but they tend to be small, and the vast majority of output is produced by large corporations, even though that's a small set of the total number of firms. Right, in the U.S., about 75% of all for-profit firms are legally organized as proprietorships with one owner. Right, but publicly traded corporations, or C-corps, account for most of the output, 70% of employment, about 75% of sales. Okay, so there are lots and lots of small firms, but a few large firms, mostly organized as corporations, tend to produce most of the stuff. Okay. What do we mean by corporate structure as opposed to organizational structure more generally? Right, well, in the U.S. and in other Western economies, there are particular characteristics of the C-corp or the corporate form of organization, right? First, corporations have the legal standing of an individual. What that means is the legal system, the law, treats corporations as if they were legal persons, meaning they can write contracts, corporations can sign agreements, corporations can sue and can be sued in court. Okay. Typical feature of the corporate structure is that there's a board of directors, right? Shareholders tend to own small fractions of the total stock, and so they tend to elect a group that engages in governance of the managers on the shareholders' behalf, right? So the board of directors has primary decision control rights, i.e. supervises the top-level managers. The shareholder owners typically have limited liability, meaning that anyone who wants to sue the firm for not paying its bills or whatever cannot go after the personal assets of the shareholders. Only shareholders are only liable for debts up to the amount that they have invested in the firm. Their personal wealth is shielded. Right? But within these boundaries, corporations have a lot of latitude in the kind of governance procedures that they establish inside. Right? How will hiring and firing decisions be made, and how will production decisions be made, and so on. Right? Those rules of the game, corporations have a lot of latitude in how they specify those rules of the game, subject, of course, to a whole bunch of state intervention, of course. Well, you know, we usually think of corporations having publicly traded shares, but that isn't a necessary characteristic, right? You can have privately traded corporations that are still organized as C corps, right? Maybe the shares are just held by a few family members, or it could be a private equity kind of arrangement where there's no public secondary market on which the shares trade. What is it that, given the structure, what is it that corporations try to achieve? You know, what are the objectives of corporate governance? Well, we typically think of things like, you know, maximizing the market value of the firm, maximizing profits, maximizing rate of return on the equity, having the highest possible stock price, and so on. Maybe protecting the longevity of the assets in particular cases, maybe meeting some legal requirements. And of course, nowadays it's very fashionable to talk about social responsibility, right? That corporations should also try to protect the environment, or assure sustainability, or paying workers a living wage and all those kinds of things. It could be the case that shareholders do value those non-monetary objectives and, you know, instruct the board of directors to impose those kinds of, to give the managers incentives to do those kinds of things. Empirically, most shareholders are not particularly interested in those kinds of things, and in their capacity as shareholders, right? It's the old Milton Friedman argument from the 70s, right? That typically shareholders would prefer that the firm focus on maximizing profit and returning, generating as much value for shareholders as possible. And the shareholders are then free to use their accumulated wealth to engage in whatever philanthropic or social or charitable endeavors that they wish to. It isn't at all clear why we would want the firm to do those things on our behalf as shareholders, okay? And my phone's ringing, but I'm not going to get it because you guys are too important. Okay. I prefer this image of environmental and social responsibility to the one I had before. Okay. How can we analyze the kinds of issues that relate to corporate governance and corporate control? Well, the granddaddy of all economic issues related to the corporation, particularly the publicly traded corporation, is the alleged separation of ownership and control. Okay, the separation of ownership and control. What is sometimes called the Burley and Means problem, because it was originally spelled out in a famous book by two Roosevelt-era intellectuals, Adolph Burley and Gardner Means. Burley was a law professor at Columbia. Means was a big shot in the Roosevelt administration. And they wrote this book based, from the point of view of critics of capitalism, right? These guys were not friendly to the capitalist system. And they said, look, you free market guys want to argue that firms are controlled or governed by their owners, and that the invisible hand leads to an efficient allocation of resources because firms want to maximize profit, and the only way they can do that is by satisfying consumer wants, blah, blah, blah. However, said Burley and Means, even if that had been true at some point in the past, it certainly isn't true today in the modern era, i.e. in the 1930s, because most production does not take place in small owner-operated enterprises, but rather in these huge corporations that are not managed by their owners, but rather are managed by a class of salaried professional managers who may or may not be acting in the interests of their shareholders. Okay? So, according to Burley and Means, we cannot assume that firms are maximizing profits. We cannot assume, right, as Mises does, that capitalists are at the mercy of the consumer, that they're captain of a ship, but they must steer the ship in the direction desired by the passengers, the consumers, and so on, because they have to satisfy consumers and make them happy. No, none of that's true in a large corporation, according to Burley and Means. Because the owners really don't know what the managers are doing, and the managers can operate the firms for their own benefit, to maximize power, prestige, social status, on-the-job perks, etc. There's not a thing the shareholders can do about it, because they're so small relative to the firm itself. Okay, this is, as some of you have recognized already, this is just another way of describing what, in modern language, we would call the principal agent problem. That there is a big agency problem within the corporation, according to this argument. Right? The principal in a corporation is the shareholders, the agent, or agents are the managers, and the principals cannot control perfectly what the managers do, what the agent does. So, the principal can try to offer the agent some incentives, pay the managers in stock rather than cash, give them some performance targets and so on, but the owners can never know for sure if the stock or the profitability or whatever, is due to the actions of managers or due to things that are beyond the manager's control, right? So it isn't possible to align the interests of managers with owners perfectly. You can try to mitigate the agency problem a little bit, but it'll still be there. Moreover, corporate managers will not want to be paid exclusively in variable pay, right, in stock options and bonuses and so on, because that exposes them to a lot of risk. Remember the basic trade-off between providing incentives for strong performance and insuring agents against risk that we talked about last time. If we apply that model here, we would say that the owners of the corporation can never perfectly align the incentives, align managers' incentives with their own. You can never get the managers to act exactly like owners unless they are, in fact, owners, okay? That's the basic incentive problem as it applies in the corporate context. Now, there are a few important points that we should make in response to Burley and Means, just at the preliminary level for starters. Right, one potential response is to say, well, look, if the corporate form of organization is so inefficient because agency costs are so high, then it seems odd that the corporate form has survived as long as it has. Right? If we think there are evolutionary competitive selection mechanisms operating in the business environment, then more efficient organizational forms should outlast or outsurvive less efficient organizational forms. And the fact that the corporation has survived and endured as long as it has, the corporate form of organization, that suggests that maybe the agency problems are not that bad, or that there are other benefits that more than outweigh those agency problems. Now, some people might counter respond and say, well, yeah, but the corporation has a lot of special privileges from the state, it gets preferred regulatory or tax treatment, there's a lot of state intervention that, you know, in the market for organizational form, which is certainly true, and therefore we can't really draw any inferences from survival other than the surviving forms, you know, maybe they're just the ones that are better connected politically. I'll address that argument specifically next week. Just for now, I'll say I don't find that argument very compelling. I think there's state intervention that benefits and hurts a number of different organizational forms, and it's far from obvious that the net effect of the interventionist state is to favor this one particular organizational form over all others. But again, I'll explain in more detail why I think that's the case next week. For right now, we'll just note that, you know, at least there's sort of a prima facie case you can make that, well, the corporations, you know, must be doing something right. Right? And one of the things we do know about it, one of the things it does right, is, you know, the corporation is an extremely effective means for accumulating large amounts of capital, you know, within a particular firm. I mean, you know, that's why the corporate form emerged and diffused in the first place. Right? A proprietorship is limited in scope to the amount of funds the proprietor either has himself or can borrow from his friends or get from the bank and so on. Right? Likewise with partnerships and other kinds of companies that can only borrow or only have the equity that is owned by the principals, the partners, whatever. Right? With a corporation, by issuing shares of stock and selling them to the wider public, you could raise, you know, much, much larger amounts of capital at low cost than you could by bringing in additional partners or whatever. Now, of course, that has to be balanced against the drawbacks of having a large number of owners, of having managers who themselves do not own major equity stakes, and so on. But again, we're always comparing benefits and costs of alternative organizational forms. No organizational form is perfect. Right? We want to avoid the Nirvana fallacy. We're simply weighing benefits and costs among feasible alternatives. Okay. One thing that we can say about the top-level architecture, if you like, of U.S. corporations is that, you know, it can actually be quite complex, right? So decision rights are typically divided among a select group of what we might call stakeholders, to use the common parlance, right? There are the shareholders themselves who retain certain decision rights, like the right to elect the board. There's the governing board, which reserves decision rights about relating to day-to-day supervision of managers. Top managers themselves have some decision rights, to be sure. And external monitors, I don't mean regulators necessarily, but ratings agencies, creditors, other sort of information providers, they also have a role in monitoring and governing the activities of the corporation. Right? It's important to keep in mind the distinction between what we might call decision rights and decision control. Right, decision control means what you actually do, whereas decision rights includes things that you choose to delegate to others. Right, so I'm just repeating a point that I made elsewhere earlier during the semester, that even if shareholders choose not to exercise certain decision rights, even if the board chooses to delegate some things to managers, that doesn't mean that the shareholders and the board don't possess these important decision rights. They may just choose not to exercise them on a regular basis, but to find other people and hire other people who can exercise them more effectively. Okay? Let's talk about some specific control mechanisms that can be used to limit the amount of managerial discretion within a corporation. Again, you know, to defend the corporation, so to speak, in other words, to maintain that the corporation can, under certain circumstances, be an effective means of organizing economic activity, we don't need to show that the corporation is perfect, right? We don't need to show, well, Burley and Means, you know, didn't get anything right. There is no separation of ownership and control. There are no principal-agent problems within the large firm. No, we don't need to show that at all, which is fortunate because it wouldn't be true, right? I mean, no doubt there is managerial discretion within the firm. No doubt there are agency problems within large firms. No doubt managers do engage in some behavior, discretionary behavior, that is not in the interests of the firm's owners. The question is, how much? Right? Is it a lot or is it a little? compared to the inefficiencies that we find in competing organizational forms. So really what I want to argue today is simply that within the corporate form, right, there are some very important and potentially effective mechanisms of control. And it's useful to distinguish between internal mechanisms and external mechanisms. Let's start with the internal mechanisms, right? Let's think about the shareholders. The shareholders are the ultimate owners of the corporation, right? They don't tend to participate on a daily basis in management of the firm's shares. You know, they might just sit and watch their stock portfolios. They might be day traders who don't really have any operational expertise or even interest. They do, however, participate in electing the board, which oversees management, right? They sometimes have some, you know, the rights to ratify certain decisions. If you hold, if you own stock or if you own shares in mutual funds, you know, you get proxy ballots in the mail every once in a while asking you to approve or withhold your approval from certain decisions made by the board or by top management. As we've already said, shareholders do tend to delegate most of their control rights to others, which doesn't mean they don't have them, right? You know, in terms of the incentives for shareholders to try to initiate, you know, changes in procedures or operations or changes in firm strategy, it's not impossible, but it's difficult, right? There are some shareholder-led, you know, important changes to corporate governance and, you know, corporate management. It's hard for individual shareholders to get these things going, right? As an individual shareholder, you know, I'm better off letting other shareholders take the initiative in challenging the managers or whatever, and I'll just sort of free ride on the behavior of those others, right? So, you know, if you like, there's a kind of a prisoner's dilemma problem, right? Where, you know, all individual shareholders might be better off if there was a group collective shareholder movement to get the firm to change, you know, from strategy A to strategy B. But no individual shareholder has a very strong incentive to do that on his own. So unless there's some kind of, you know, collective action, some kind of deliberate formation of a group, it's unlikely that change is going to come from that direction. However, large corporations also, they can also sell some of their equity to institutional investors, right? So institutional investors like pension funds, you know, in countries outside the U.S., it can be banks, other financial institutions. Those investors are not at all like the small mom-and-pop investors that Berlin Means had in mind, right? They have very substantial influence on the behavior of corporations. Mutual funds, you know, the California State Teachers Retirement Fund and so on is one of the largest institutional investors. And if you get a call from, you know, from CalPERS, this the California State Pension Fund, if you're a CEO and you get a call from them saying, you know, we're really not happy about these things your company's been doing, you're going to take that call, okay? Because they represent a big chunk of your equity, all right? So the point is simply that if you own large shares of stock, you're more likely to internalize the benefits of action and therefore more likely to take it to try to bring about corporate reform or improve performance. What about the board? Well, that's probably a little bit more than you really need to know. They typically tend to be white males in dark suits. No, that's not true. That's just a clip art. That's just true by clip art. You know, the board supervises managers but delegates most of the day-to-day authority to managers as the primary function of what we might call top-level decision control, right? Deciding which managers should be hired and fired and ratifying or, you know, sort of approving the decisions, the operational decisions that are made by managers, right? They hire, monitor, and fire the CEO. They can approve specific firm strategies. Sometimes their approval is needed for particular capital outlays and so on. You know, what do boards do? How do they work? Actually, there's a lot of variety. Boards can be very small, you know, just a handful of people. They can be quite large. Some corporate boards are in the number have members memberships numbering in the 30s. Often, typically a half or more are what they call outside directors, meaning people who do not otherwise have an affiliation with the firm. Right? So the CEO can him or herself be on the board. The CFO can be on the board. Right? So some of the board members can be insiders, but of course if you had all insiders on the board, that would defeat the purpose of having a board to engage in monitoring in the first place. Okay? As I said, the CEO is often on the board and often chairs the board meetings. A lot of the work that's done in boards goes on in small subcommittees that work on their own and then report back to the main board. Are boards really independent of top-level managers? A lot of critics of the corporation have argued that the board of directors tends to become sort of captive to or captured by the CEO and other top managers, particularly if they're very charismatic and so on, that the directors really don't want to cause much trouble for top-level managers. They're just supposed to rubber stamp the decisions that the managers make. Well, I mean, there's a lot of literature looking at board independence. And in fact, there is substantial turnover among top management personnel at the request of the board. So, at least many boards seem to act quite independently of corporate wishes. This is not something that's, can easily be determined from the outside empirically. Clearly, influential CEOs can do a lot to sway board members in one way or another. But again, what we know about corporations, their persistence, and so on, suggests that the board does play, at least, does have a real function in disciplining or providing a check on, actions of managers that might otherwise be out of alignment with what shareholders want. Another reason we know this is that, high-profile board members are often CEOs themselves of other companies. They may sit on a number of corporate boards. They may be very high-profile people in society, right, who have an interest in maintaining their reputation and not being known as just a rubber stamp for the CEO. Okay. Now, the last sort of control mechanism among the internal set would be sort of top managers themselves, right? And you might think, well, but wait a minute, isn't the whole point of control to govern or limit what top managers can do? Yeah, but there are a lot of things you can do to align the interest of these top managers with the interests of the firm's owners, the corporation's owners, its shareholders, right? Keep in mind that any authority that the CEO has comes from the board and hence from the shareholders itself, right? As the firm becomes larger and more complex, shareholders acting through the board tend to delegate more and more decision rights to the central management, right? Senior management does tend to retain important decision rights and does not delegate them even further throughout the hierarchy. And most importantly, owners acting through the board can provide incentives for top managers not to engage in a lot of discretionary behavior, not to make expenditures or take actions that benefit the managers at the expense of the shareholders. We talked about the principal agent problem last week. We distinguished between paying a fixed rate, straight salary, and providing performance-based compensation. And we explained how performance-based compensation provides strong incentives for the agent to try to act in accordance with the principal's wishes. And this could take the form of bonuses, stock options, just outright grants of ownership, and so on. So paying managers according to their performance can be a very effective way of reducing, not eliminating completely, but at least reducing the amount of managerial discretion that exists within the corporation. And last but not least, we shouldn't forget what Eugene Fama called in a famous article, the internal market for managers. In other words, there are managers competing for top positions against other managers. I sometimes think of this as sort of, the Gambino approach to corporate governance. Right? Think about a typical mafia family, right? You have John Gotti, right? The famous mobster from the 90s. The Teflon Don, they called him, because none of the charges the government threw against him would stick. But he was head of the Gambino family in New York. How did he get to be the head of the Gambino family? You know, was he hired by a search committee that looked, you know, all throughout New York or Italy, and he sent in his application? They interviewed him. Did he get promoted? No, I mean, right? He whacked the previous head of the Gambino family. That's how you typically ascend to the head of a crime family in the mob, is you kill the previous don. Now, you know, why did Gotti think he could? How did he get away with that? Well, it must have been the case that there was some unhappiness within the family with the performance of the previous don, right? Otherwise, if Gotti had just killed the don without any backup and support, then, you know, he probably would have gotten whacked by some other guy, right? So there's a certain amount of consensus that goes on. Anyway, my point is, if you're the head of a mafia family, you better stay on your toes, right? You better use the resources of the family in ways that help to satisfy the objectives of the mafia family and not just use it to line your own pockets. Otherwise, one of your lieutenants, one of your capos, is going to take care of you, okay? As applied in the corporate context, right? But, you know, there are lots of mid-level managers and lower-level, you know, managers at the corporate office who would very much like to be CEO themselves, right? And they're watching the behavior of the CEO. And if the CEO, you know, is acting in ways that are not in the company's interest, other managers have an incentive to report this to the board, hoping that they themselves might be promoted, you know, to that top managerial slot. So there's a lot of internal monitoring that goes on among managers. And this, again, is one mechanism for limiting, not completely eliminating, but limiting or checking the extent of the Burley and Means problem, the extent of the principal agent problem, okay? Now, all these internal control mechanisms are great. They all have a place to play. They all can be effective at limiting the discretionary behavior of managers, but none is really as powerful or as effective as what we might call external control mechanisms, okay? Meaning ways of disciplining the firm that are completely outside the firm itself. What do we mean? Well, first of all, there are information sources. There are brokers of information, accounting firms, public accounting firms, stock market analysts, credit ratings agencies, and so on, who have an incentive to do some monitoring, right? To engage in monitoring of top managers on behalf of their own clients, to promote their own reputations, but in ways that are beneficial to the shareholders of the firm in question. Now, but just as an aside, right, a lot of people have said, yeah, but look how effective do you think this could really be? I mean, look at the credit ratings agencies, you know, during the real estate boom, right? None of them knew how to evaluate mortgage-backed securities, and they didn't do a very good job. You know, they gave securities much higher ratings than they ought to because they didn't know how to price these complex derivatives, or because they were in the back pocket of the firms that hired them and so on. I mean, some of that may be true, but it's one of the points that, as a few people have made in blogs, but is almost completely absent from public discussion of the financial crisis, is that in the U.S. there's a government-enforced cartel of just three credit ratings agencies. They're licensed by the state, and there's a very small oligopoly. There's no free entry into the credit ratings agency. So credit ratings industry. So it's not surprising that the performance of credit rating of the credit ratings agencies was so poor, because it's a state-protected oligopoly of three. Going back to the storyline, there's also competition in the product market. What I mean there is, the firm, you know, a large corporation, I guess it's Coca-Cola that is behind these Dasani bottled waters, right? I mean, ultimately, it wants to sell bottled water to make a profit, right? It's competing against other firms that sell bottled water, or firms that sell other kind of beverages that also compete with Coca-Cola's output, right? So if the managers of Coca-Cola are engaging in a lot of discretionary behavior, if they're using the revenues of the firm to buy themselves plush offices and to fly around on the corporate jet and to pay themselves big salaries and so on at the expense of, you know, investment and and expanding production and so on, well, that's going to show up in the firm's bottom line, right? I mean, the perks that these managers consume, those are expenses, right? So profitability is going to fall, right? Because the firm's competing with other firms, maybe they have better managers who are engaged in less managerial discretion. Now, why does that matter? Well, if the profit of the firm falls, right, that's a signal to other market participants that something's not right, and there are a number of ways they can try to rectify the situation. Anyway, but the point is, as long as the firm is competing with other firms in the market for outputs, managers have to be very careful that their discretionary behavior does not come at the expense of the firm's bottom line. Right? Now, there may be, in certain institutional settings, other private participants that can engage in external control. Maybe banks. Banks don't do a lot of monitoring in the U.S. because since the 1930s, there have been so many restrictions on what banks can do. A whole new round that's coming in with the Dodd bill. They're saying that this Dodd bill is the most comprehensive financial regulation since 1933, which of course is a frightening prospect. But in countries that give in which banks play a bigger role in governance, in Germany, for example, if banks were allowed to own equity, then banks would be like very large block holders who would be able to engage in a lot of external monitoring and control. There's clearly some external control from regulatory authorities. What exactly they're doing, how well they do it, whose interests they're trying to serve is sort of a different story. But the most important of these external control mechanisms, by far the most important in terms of the effect it has on limiting managerial discretion, is the market for corporate control. That brings us to our main subject for today's discussion, corporate governance and corporate control. A very famous article by a young law professor published in 1965 called Mergers and the Market for Corporate Control. And the author, Henry Manny, became one of the most famous and remains one of the most eminent scholars in the field of corporate governance and corporate control. Manny wrote this article that makes a very straightforward argument, and it's directly in response to Burleian Means, but one that hadn't really been taken into consideration before. His argument was the following. Imagine that managers of the firm are, as Burleian Means feared, using the firm's assets to feather their own nests. They're consuming a lot of perks. They are engaged in a lot of discretionary behavior. Well, as we just explained, right, that reduces the firm's bottom line. That hurts the profit of the firm. And the firm is going to start to perform poorly relative to its rivals, right? Now, if this is a publicly traded corporation, what is going to be a signal? What are some of the signals to outside participants that this firm is not being managed well? Well, if accounting profits start to fall, right, what's that going to do in the stock market? What's that going to do to the stock price of the firm? Well, the stock price is going to go down, right? If stock prices are ultimately driven by investor expectations about future cash flows, when the managers are consuming perks rather than running the firm efficiently, cash flows will start to fall. Outside participants will be nervous and will expect future cash flows to fall. Stock price will go down. Why is this bad for the managers? Well, it's bad for them if they're paid in stock, if they themselves are stockholders. But far beyond that, right? What does a falling stock price do? Well, this is a signal to outside market participants, to investors, to other firms, to takeover specialists like Michael Milken or Gordon Gekko or whatever, that this is sort of that this firm is undervalued, that these are underperforming assets. Under, meaning relative to what they potentially could do if they were managed properly, right? So, imagine there's a firm, Coca-Cola, whatever, it has a good product, consumers seem to like the product, but the share price is falling. That's a signal to potential new owners that the existing owners are not exercising their entrepreneurial judgment rights very effectively. Right? So bad managers are getting away with a lot of discretionary behavior. So what does that mean? Well, that it means that somebody like Michael Milken can try to acquire control of the firm by purchasing stock at this depressed price, try to then reorganize the firm, restructure the firm, kick out the poorly performing managers, get a new board of directors, right, and then take the firm public again at a higher price, therefore earning a profit in the meanwhile. So the so-called corporate raider, someone who specializes in buying and selling stock to try to acquire control of and then divest control of corporate assets, can make a lot of money by picking out, you know, poorly performing firms and replacing the management team. In other words, if I'm an incumbent manager of a large corporation, I'm worried about losing my job. I'm worried that if I don't do what shareholders want, if I don't focus on profits, if I don't try to maintain the stock market value of the firm will get taken over in a hostile takeover, will be acquired by another company, or will be bought out in a leveraged buyout, an LBO, and then I'll be out of a job. That's bad for me, that hurts my reputation, and so on. I don't want that. So I want to limit my managerial discretion to, you know, just a little bit, so that my job is safe, so that my job is more secure. Okay? To put it another way, management failure opens the door to a hostile takeover. It also, you know, closes the door to further professional opportunities. That doesn't always happen. Here in Missouri, a poorly performing manager of Sprint, a guy named Gary Forsey, was fired. He was forced out by the board. There wasn't a hostile takeover of Sprint, but there was enough concern about his performance that he was fired by the board. And, you know, the poor guy had no other career opportunities available to him but to become president of the University of Missouri, and hence my ultimate boss. Hope he's not listening to this. You know, Manny's argument, while not made explicitly in this way by Mises, is very similar to an argument that is offered by Mises in Human Action. Right? Mises makes a more general point about the role of the stock market, of financial markets, and so on, in corporate governance in a great passage in Human Action. And it's very interesting. This discussion actually takes place in the part in Human Action where Mises is talking about socialism, where he's responding to the market socialists. I'll get to that point in just a second. Mises says of the Burleian means doctrine, without identifying it by name, he says, the Burleian means doctrine disregards entirely the role that the capital and money market, the stock and bond exchange, which a pertinent idiom simply calls the market, plays in the direction of corporate business. The changes in the prices of common and preferred stock and of corporate bonds are the means applied by the capitalists for the supreme control of the flow of capital. The price structure, as determined by speculations on capital and money markets and on the big commodity exchanges, not only decides how much capital is available for the conduct of each corporation's business, it creates a state of affairs to which the managers must adjust their operations in detail. Think about that, right? What's going on in the stock market? The decisions of capitalist entrepreneurs, financial entrepreneurs to buy and sell stock and so on, creates a set of conditions, a state of affairs, to which the managers must adjust their operations in detail. In other words, according to Mises, managerial discretion is ultimately constrained by the decision of financial market participants. What goes on in capital markets, money markets, stock and bond markets, etc., places the ultimate limits on what salaried managers, what corporate managers, can get away with. Now, why is he bringing up this point in the context of socialism? Note, by the way, that Mises doesn't explain in a step-by-step fashion the exact takeover mechanism as spelled out by Manny in Manny's article, but Mises' argument is very much in the same spirit. Right, that it's ultimately things that go on in the financial markets that constrain, that limit, that govern what corporate managers can do. It's not that corporate managers ultimately control everything. Okay, now why does he bring this up in the context of socialism? Well, if you've ever studied or followed the economic calculation debate, I mean, I touch on it in chapter one of the book. Right, you know, there was this sort of back and forth between the Austrians and their critics, and responses by the Austrians and responses by the critics, and so on. A group of socialist writers in the 1930s, who came to be called market socialists, had responded to Mises and Hayek by saying, well, Mises was worried about calculation, Hayek's worried about knowledge, and so on. Forget about that. All we need to do is set up factories and put managers, directors in charge of those factories, and tell these managers to do exactly what capitalist managers do. Okay, what does the manager of a capitalist firm do? According to sort of the neoclassical economics that these critics were steeped in, well, you choose the level of production to set marginal revenues equal to marginal cost. How much capital is available for you to work with? Well, whatever the capital market gave you. So you take your capital and you go off and run with it. According to these market socialists, why couldn't, the government just do the same thing? Don't have asset markets. Don't have stock markets. Maybe you could have some markets for consumer goods. Maybe you could have labor markets. But just put the government, let the government own all capital goods. And the government can just, choose how big each factory is going to be, stick a manager in there and say, hey, choose the level of output such that marginal revenue is equal to marginal cost. Off you go. How, according to these market socialists, would that be any different from capitalism? Well, here Mises points out that the market socialists fundamentally misunderstand the nature of the economic problem. As Mises puts it, these critics see the problem from the point of view of the plant manager. Mises uses the wonderful Misesian term, a subaltern clerk, a mere subordinate. The market socialists think economic activity is just about choosing how fast to run the assembly line based on, equating MR and MC. No, the real problem is deciding how much capital gets allocated to each firm, to each industry, to each specific entrepreneur, and so on. And that is what market socialism cannot do. Right? Remember we were talking before about Mises' claim that you have to have stock market to be a fully capitalist society. This is really what he means, that the ultimate decisions in a free market, in the free market, about production, about the allocation of resources to different branches of production, is not made by managers. It's made by financiers, by financial market participants, by capital market participants. Okay, that's where the real governance in a market economy takes place. Okay. Now, we'll talk a little bit more about the role, what the state does next week, but just a few things worth mentioning now. Of course, there's a lot of state intervention in the practices and policies that we've just described. The state enforces different kinds of reporting restrictions. Sorry, I've got a small mistake in my slide. I'll just leave it. Okay. I'll make that picture bigger though. The government requires corporations to file certain forms, to disclose certain standardized information to the Securities and Exchange Commission. There are all kinds of restrictions on trading of equities, particularly by so-called insiders, right? So people intimately involved with the firm, managers, employees, are not allowed to buy and sell stock based on any knowledge they have that is, quote, non-public. We can get into that a little bit in the Q&A period because there's a lot of problems with that whole concept of insider information. I don't think it really makes sense. But anyway, there are laws restricting the buying and selling of stock by certain people who have certain legal relationships with the firm. Very interesting book by a legal scholar named Mark Rowe. His picture's there on the slide. He wrote a book in 1994 called Strong Managers, Weak Owners. He's written a series of related articles and actually has another book arguing that, the kinds of things that Burley and Means were worried about is really not a natural outgrowth of the market process, but is really an artificial result of legal restrictions on banks. So Rowe thinks that it would be better if we had a system more like the German system, or the Japanese system, where banks are allowed to engage in corporate governance and corporate control. In the U.S., they're not, because the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 restricts, basically eliminates what banks can do. Banks can't own equities of corporations, of manufacturing corporations, and so on, and cannot engage in the kind of monitoring and governance that Roe argues goes on fairly effectively in other countries where banks are allowed to do those kinds of things. Of course, there are laws against takeovers, right? There are all kinds of laws that say, a lot of them at the state rather than federal level, that say that, you know, if I want to buy shares of Coca-Cola and hope to accumulate enough shares that I can take effective control of the board and I can force out the poorly performing managers and so on, I have to announce my intentions ahead of time. You know, if I acquire more than 2% or 3% of the equity, I have to state publicly whether or not I'm trying to take over the firm. Well, I mean, what's that? Well, that's just an early warning system for poorly performing incumbent managers so they can, you know, get ready their defense and so on. It's not surprising that anti-takeover laws are lobbied for and supported very heavily by interest groups that represent managers of existing firms, okay? Just in the interest of time, we won't talk a lot about Sarbanes-Oxley. That was the most important piece of corporate governance legislation prior to the new Dodd bill that I haven't had a chance to read yet. But Sarbanes-Oxley establishes a lot of fairly costly restrictions, you know, as a response to the Enron scandal and so on what it eliminates or outlaws a lot of common governance practices. There's more government oversight, new accounting oversight board, certain kinds of transactions between companies and their managers are prohibited, hold CEOs and CFOs, you know, personally, legally liable for errors or misstatements on financial statements, which I think is a pretty poor idea, increases the penalties for misreporting financial information and so on. The argument that many Austrian economists would give is that, look, in a market setting, there are strong incentives for investors to engage in these kind of monitoring practices on their own, right? To set up their own accounting firms, ratings agencies, supervisory boards, and so on. There's incentives for stock markets themselves as private companies, the New York Stock Exchange or the Chicago Board of Trade. If we think of them as profit maximizing entities, they have incentives to establish uniform listing requirements, to enforce certain kinds of disclosure requirements. If firms don't want to participate in that, well, then the exchange refuses to let them list their stock on that exchange. Right, so there are a lot of private incentives, a lot of incentives for private institutions to engage in the kinds of monitoring and governance behaviors that laws like Sarbanes-Oxley and so on, you know, are designed to create at the government level. Okay. Last but not least, does all this stuff work? Well, there's an interesting entrepreneurship point to be made here before we wrap it up for questions. You know, there are a lot of critics of the Manny argument on corporate control. Paradoxically, they sometimes make incompatible arguments, right? Sometimes they argue on the one hand that, look, you know, it's true that takeovers can be a way of disciplining incumbent managers, but the firm that's engaged in the takeover could be doing it as a form of empire building, right? So firm A could be taking over firm B, or acquiring firm B, not to discipline the managers of firm B, but as a perk for the managers of firm A. So a lot of takeovers, a lot of acquisitions, these critics claim, are really not about making the system more efficient. They're just creating wealth and power for the firms that are doing the taking over. Right? Well, of course, you see, this just pushes back the corporate control problem to another level. Right? And I don't know, I went and saw Inception this past weekend, so I'm thinking about pushing things up and down levels. I won't spoil anything for you if you haven't seen it. But right, so we'd want to say, well, if firm A is engaging in takeovers that are not efficient, they're not generating value but are merely a kind of a perk for those managers, well, then there are yet other, you know, takeover artists and other firms that would wish to discipline those managers, right, and so on. A lot of these critics also paradoxically claim that there aren't enough takeovers, or at least there aren't enough good takeovers, right? And their argument is that, well, you know, there's a kind of free rider problem facing individual shareholders. And they had the following kind of example in mind, right? Suppose that Carl here, is a corporate raider, and I currently hold shares of Coca-Cola that are trading for $10 a piece. And a Carl comes to me and says, "Hey, I'll give you $15 if you'll tender your share to me." So he makes a so-called tender offer, right? He offers to purchase the shares, everybody's share of Coca-Cola for $15 a share. You think, well, that's a no-brainer, right? If I've got something that's currently trading at 10 and this fool is willing to pay me 15, of course I'd sell to him. But the argument goes, if I'm clever, I think, well, now wait a minute. Carl's a corporate raider. Why would he be willing to offer me 15 for my shares? It must be because he thinks they're really worth 20, or they could be worth 20 after he fixes up the firm. So I might say, hey, sorry. I'm just going to hold on to my shares and hope that enough other shareholders will be willing to tender at 15 to give Carl control of the firm, and he'll reorganize, he'll kick out the bad managers, he'll fix everything up, and then he'll sell off at 20, and I'll just kind of go along for the ride. Okay? But if all shareholders are thinking that, then nobody is willing to tender his shares at 15, and Carl cannot acquire control of the company, the bad managers stay in place, and the firm, is still trading at 10. That's the argument, that sort of in equilibrium disciplinary takeovers won't happen. What's the problem with this? Well, again, that argument ignores the role of uncertainty. It ignores the role of uncertainty. Okay? So in my example, the shares of Coca-Cola are currently trading at $10 a share on the stock exchange. That's a real fact. Okay? And here's a raider, and he's offering me 15 today. That's real. How much the stock might be worth in the future if the raider is able to do all these things he wants to do, that is not known, right? That's uncertain. I mean, maybe Carl acquires control of the firm by getting enough shares at 15, and he tries to turn it around, but he fails. He can't get it to work. Turns out to be a much more complicated business than he thought. He can't find any better managers than the ones he already had. Maybe the whole thing goes down the toilet, and he ends up selling it at 5, right? So by holding on to my shares at 10, I might lose money, right? Or maybe Carl is moderately successful, right? Or sorry, maybe he's not quite as unsuccessful as that, but maybe the best he can do is get the shares where they're worth 12.50, and he sells it off. Okay. And if I still held on to, right, I refused to sell at 15. Now I've got something that's only worth 12.50. So I made a mistake. I should have taken his offer at 15. But the point is, nobody knows for sure what the price is going to be. If Carl is successful, right, if he is able to turn around the firm and then sell it off for a higher price per share than what he paid for it, then minus interest and minus the opportunity cost of his labor, he has earned a pure entrepreneurial profit. Okay? But not everybody wants to bear that uncertainty. A lot of shareholders will say, I'll take the bird in the hand rather than the two in the bush. Give me my 15, let me cash out. Okay? So, the successful raider is a successful entrepreneur, right? The gains from engaging in these sort of corporate control transactions, less interest and implicit wage, are entrepreneurial profit. Those who are unsuccessful earn entrepreneurial losses, right? And not everyone wants to bear that uncertainty, okay? So disciplinary takeovers of this type will take place because we're not in an equilibrium ERE kind of world. We're in a real world of Knightian uncertainty, okay? I have a few comments here about government intervention, specific aspects of government intervention, but I think I'll save those for next week. Ultimately, at the end of the day, is the government the right agency to protect shareholders from harm? Well, there's a huge literature on regulation of quality and safety, and this is really just an aspect of that. And the bottom line of this literature goes that government tends not to be very good at protecting quality, regulating quality and safety. Government itself doesn't work very well. Securities laws and regulation tend to help inefficient incumbents at the expense of more efficient entrants. And as I mentioned before, most of these things, monitoring and governance can be done very effectively by private parties. Okay. That's the end of the show. There's a lot of great questions already in the chat window, so let me scroll up and see if I can read some of them and address them. Some of these are about the exam. Let me scroll down to where we have some substance. Yeah, by the way, Daniel, when saying I liked Wall Street, I'm saying I certainly don't agree with Oliver Stone's political philosophy. But, you know, there is a sense that when you watch the original Wall Street, even though Oliver Stone is condemning Gordon Gekko and so on, you know, the way he portrays kind of the excitement, the adrenaline of being a financial market participant in those heady days of the 1980s, you know, it's really quite amazing. I mean, it seems like a great world, a world that you would want to be in. So much passion, so much energy. I mean, that's capitalism right there. Except for the foolish parts of the movie, and especially what Gekko says about money isn't made, it's just transferred from one person to another. That's, of course, completely goofy. Let's see, what else? Jeremiah is a C Corp defined by size or I lost where you were here. My scroll window is messed up. No, it's not by size. So you can be some legal forms in the U.S. do have an upper size restriction, but there's a lot of size flexibility within the forms. So that isn't really the big deal. I didn't say a lot about all this popular stakeholder stuff about sustainability and hugging trees and all that. I mean, we can have a great discussion about that on the forums. It's a very fashionable topic now to claim that firms should not simply try to maximize profit or market value, but rather should try to pursue all these other social goals. I think the basic Friedman argument is still right, that whether or not those goals are meritorious doesn't seem to be a very effective means of pursuing them. To have us give our money to corporations by buying stock and then let the corporations, help assuage our consciences. No, we should deal with our conscience the way we want to, by giving directly to charitable organizations or working through other means to achieve whatever social or environmental objectives might float your boat. It doesn't seem very efficient to ask salaried managers to do this in their roles as CEOs, okay? They don't have any particular expertise in philanthropy, environment, or whatever it might be. Some questions about the video. More things about the exam. Daniel liked Inception. I'm scrolling down here. Yeah, a lot of great comments. I don't really know. I don't see any questions that I can illuminate. I agree with what you guys are saying. Good stuff, good stuff, good stuff. The weather in Missouri stinks. We have really horrible summers, but we make up for it with really horrible winters. Let's see. Abalash has an old question. Thank you. Let me turn to this old question. Actually, I'll put it over here where you guys can see it. Limited liability. Okay. Is it okay to bring up limited liability now? Sure. Limited liability applies to shareholders alone. Bondholders... Abalash, what you're asking is kind of the big libertarian... The question at the heart of the libertarian debate over limited liability. I think almost everyone agrees that in a free market, parties would be free to negotiate, lenders and borrowers could negotiate over terms and put in whatever contractual provisions they want, right? So if I want to raise money for my company, I could go to the bank and I could say, look, I want to borrow money from you. But if I can't pay it back, you know, according to the contract, the most you can get is, you know, this collateral that I put up. You cannot come after my house and my car and my kids' college fund. Now, somebody else, another entrepreneur, could go to the bank and say, hey, I'm so confident in my own abilities that I'll put right here in the contract that if I can't pay you back, you can get my house and you can get my college, my kids' college fund, and I'll throw in my kids, too. You know, presumably, that second entrepreneur would be able to borrow at a lower interest rate than the first entrepreneur. You know, so is it worth it to offer all those things in exchange for buying a few points off the interest rate? Well, I mean, who knows? That would be up for the entrepreneurs, the borrowers, and the creditors to sort of work out. So I think everyone agrees that that kind of limited liability against creditors, is not an artificial byproduct of state intervention, and presumably would be an option, you know, in a pure sort of free market setting. But what about limited liability against torts? Okay, so, you know, in the case of BP, if BP dumps a bunch of oil into the ocean and it washes up on my beachfront property and it ruins my land, you know, and I sue BP for damages, you know, can I go after the personal assets of BP stockholders? Right, well, under current limited liability law, which is codified at least by the state, no, I can't. Right, I can sue BP for its assets, but I cannot go after the personal assets of BP shareholders. And a lot of libertarian critics have argued that that is an artificial state privilege. Okay, that in a pure free market society, there would be no immunity against tort claims, and that shareholders should be legally liable for torts committed by employees. Okay, all I want to say at this point is that it turns out that's a much more complicated legal argument than it might appear on the surface. I think some libertarian critics of the corporation have sort of asserted with that argument, well, that of course employers should be legally liable, including, you know, their personal assets should be liable for the actions of their employees. But there are a lot of legal theories that say that, well, no, I mean, look, it depends on, you need kind of a theory of culpability, right? And this is a very tricky issue in libertarian legal theory and lots of different aspects of different kinds of legal theories, right? So people say that if, you know, or here's an example. If, you know, if I tell my child, so say I have a child under the age of 18, and, you know, I put a gun in his hand and I say, I want you to go over and shoot this person, and my child shoots that person dead. But under most theories of jurisprudence, I would bear some culpability, maybe all of the culpability for what my child did. You say, well, the child wasn't in a position to make up his own mind. He was doing what his father told him, and, you know, the child shouldn't be responsible. The father should go to jail for what the child did. Okay, what about, you know, a cult? Remember, you know, like the old Charles Manson cult from the 70s. Charles Manson told his followers to go commit horrible crimes. Were the followers immune from responsibility because they were kind of brainwashed by this charismatic cult figure? It's a little bit more complicated. Some people say yes, some people say no, right? Most people agree that, you know, the so-called Nuremberg defense, you know, the Nazi concentration camp guard who says, yeah, I killed all these inmates, I shot these people, but I was just following orders. People agree that doesn't absolve the concentration camp guard for the responsibility for his own actions, right? So, in other words, you know, if I'm a shareholder of BP, right now, if I, one case is I went to the guys operating the rig and I told them, I said, hey, I want you to cut corners. I don't want you to install a bunch of safety equipment. You know, go ahead. Who cares if there's an accident and oil spills up on Peter Klein's beachfront property? I command you to go and engage in this risky behavior. Then you might be able to make a case in court that the shareholder, you know, is legally responsible for the property damage that was done, and if BP doesn't have enough money, that shareholder should be responsible. On the other hand, you know, if the shareholder said, look, you know, I instruct my managers to behave in the following ways, but without my knowledge or consent, they did a bunch of other stuff that caused these damages, should the shareholder be culpable? Yeah, it's not totally clear. If I hire a guy to, you know, to drive my delivery van for, if I'm a sole proprietor, and I hire Grayson to drive the van, and I say, go deliver, you know, bread to the grocery store, you know, from my bakery, and Grayson drives like a maniac and drives up on the sidewalk and knocks somebody over and you know, injures them. Should I, as the proprietor, be legally liable for what Grayson did? I didn't tell him to drive on the sidewalk. Now, I didn't tell him to run people over. So he wasn't really acting within the scope of the authority that I delegated to him. So some legal scholars would argue I should not be legally responsible. So this is a very long-winded way of saying, personally, I think this is kind of a red herring issue. I don't think this is really specific to the corporation, right? So if someone commits a tort, to what extent is that person's employer or that person's sort of superior up the hierarchical chain legally culpable for what that person did? That really depends on the situation. It varies on a case-by-case basis. It's not, I don't think it's automatically, I don't think it automatically goes one way or the other just because we're talking about a corporation where the ultimate owner is a shareholder as opposed to some other organizational form. Okay, again, this is something I really want to get into next week. Abhilash, does that sort of get at what you're interested in? Did I at least tackle your question without giving away all my secrets for next week? Kind of. Okay. Well, that's all you get for now. Sorry. Let me see what Luke's question is. There's something about Doug, something that Doug Casey wrote. I haven't seen that before. Okay, Dean's got a link to... Okay, yeah, I don't know that I can address all of those links at the moment. Yeah, I mean, Dean has got some stuff from Rothbard on incitement, and that's exactly the that's exactly the kind of issue that we're talking about, right? So, you know, but does the mere fact of being a shareholder constitute incitement in the sense that you can be held responsible for torts committed by your employees? I'm not sure. It's not obvious to me that the answer is yes. Okay, any other questions? So how about other topics about corporate control, about takeovers? It's already 6:30, but I can stick around for a few extra minutes. Okay, Dean has typed a question here. If market participants think a given acquisition is a bad idea, they can short the acquiring company and go long the company being acquired. Yeah, that's absolutely right. If the takeover involves a significant stock portion, that would make the takeover more expensive and give the speculator a chance to profit if the takeover is abandoned. That's right. Do you know if anyone has studied stock price fluctuations between the announcement and completion of mergers to compare whether takeovers exhibiting the pattern indicated have a greater incidence of divestiture in the future? No, I don't. There are a lot of studies of stock price movements around the time of acquisition announcements. Right, there are lots and lots of studies of so-called announcement effects as proxies for, you know, market beliefs about the ultimate profitability of the acquisition or the divestiture or whatever it might be. Offhand, I can't think of a paper that looks specifically at the relationship between the pattern you just described and some kind of ex post performance, but I'm going to write that down. I don't know, I might want to write that paper myself if it hasn't already been written. But no, Dean, offhand, I don't know of anybody who has looked at that, but it's certainly worth looking at. Grayson's asking some questions about Kirshner, Salerno. Oh gosh, you want to open the whole Pandora's box of the dehomogenization debate. Okay, let me see if I can address it briefly without getting myself into any trouble here. Okay, Kirshner replaces uncertainty bearing with discovery, yes. According to Salerno, Kirshner also replaces choice with discovery and makes discovery the basis of all economics. I mean, what Salerno is... I think that's basically right. I think Salerno is right here, but I'm not sure if I would phrase it in exactly the same way, but Salerno's claim is that Kirshner, you know, goes beyond simply characterizing alertness or discovery as one aspect of behavior that leads to a equilibration, but that he almost eliminates the whole concept of purpose of choice, and takes alertness as a kind of external force, rather than focusing on the sort of deliberative, conscious, judgmental decision-making of the actor. I think that goes beyond, you know, the scope of our course. But yeah, I think that's a legitimate critique of Kirzner. And, you know, as it would apply to the kinds of things we're talking about here, and you could look at this sort of distinction between alertness and judgment and maybe make the claim that by making alertness and discovery the hallmark of entrepreneurship, by focusing on opportunities that are kind of exogenously given, we kind of reduce the role of agency, of the human agent, right? That, you know, some people, for whatever reason, are alert, other people aren't. The opportunities sort of fall from the sky, and people can grasp them instantly and costlessly. It kind of takes away from the deliberative, decisive, what Salerno, the process of what Salerno calls appraisement, trying to anticipate what future prices will be, that, you know, according to the Knight and sort of Mises view, as I've characterized it, lies at the heart of entrepreneurship. Let me just take one more question before I conk out here. The evolution of the corporation. Yeah, does the state prefer the corporation over the sole proprietorship? Jeremiah, again, all I'm going to do now is give a teaser answer, because that's really going to be a big focus of next week's discussion. My bottom line is, yes, of course, absolutely, there are state privileges that go to corporations that don't go to other forms of organization. However, there are also some costs in terms of tax policy and regulation and so on that corporations bear more than other forms of organization. So it isn't clear to me on balance that the state prefers the corporate form to all other forms of organization. There are things on both sides of the ledger here. The state likes some things about corporations. In some sense, they're easier for the state to control. They're easier for the state to tax and exploit and so on. At the same time, corporations, you know, especially large ones, do a lot of things that the state doesn't like. And sometimes it's easier for the state to maintain control over smaller entities. So it really depends firm by firm. It depends industry by industry. It isn't at all obvious to me that there's, you know, that in general the state prefers the corporate form. There's some things it likes about it, but some things that it doesn't. But again, this will be a big subject for us to talk about next week. Speaking of which, I'm going to sign off now. If you're still having problems retrieving your exam scores or making sense of them, please let Grayson or Dan or myself know ASAP. Within the next day or so, we'll have some additional things posted for you on the forum, maybe a new quiz to check, a new non-graded quiz, and I'll let you know as soon as possible what the assigned readings are going to be for next week. So, without further ado, good night, everybody, and I will talk to you soon.